Hello and welcome to David's Book Talk, and today we have a very special, interesting guest. He's going to talk about UFOs in his book, Reflections of a UFO Investigator. His name is Kevin Randall, and he's here to talk about this wonderful book. Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I am fine.
Now, tell me how you say the name of this publishing company. Is it Anomalist Books?
Anomalist Books, yeah.
I said it right. I was so afraid I was going to say the name of the publishing company wrong. Tell me, is this your 20th UFO book?
Something like that.
Something. Do you lose 20, track?
21, 22, something like that. Brad Steiger and I are trying to figure out who's written the most UFO books. It's one of us.
Is it a competition?
Not much of one.
Do you consider yourself an expert on UFOs?
Well, I've written 20 books, so I think that would sort of suggest I believe that.
Yes. But do you believe it? there's the kick there. I believe it. I mean, you know an awful lot. I mean, just from reading this book, I mean, all the facts, the details. You obviously have written down and recorded all these details of all these investigations, and it's just fascinating to read.
Well, it's because I pay attention.
And other people don't.
That's right.
We know that for a fact, that we all have people in our lives and we know don't pay attention. I've been accused of saying, people accuse me of not paying attention too. But I'm sort of one of these people who listen and then don't always take it in.
That's because you're not paying attention.
But it's weird because I do it, but then sometimes it just goes right out of my head right afterwards. Do you ever have that problem?
Frequently, especially at my advanced age now.
Well, you're on the cover of that UFO magazine, the one that we were talking about last week when I called.
Yes.
And you look really young on the cover.
Which is bizarre because I was, 52, I think, when that picture, 52, 53 when the picture was taken.
Right off the bat, it begs the question, why the UFO? Now, I know your mother was interested in sci-fi stuff, but why are you so into UFOs?
I suspect because it's the suggestion of interstellar flight possibilities. If there is no interstellar flight, then there are no UFOs. And if there are UFOs, then interstellar flight is possible. And I would like to believe that we're going to be out of the solar system at some point. So interstellar flight is possible. I don't know how far out we can get. I don't know whether we can get outside the galaxy because the galaxy is tremendously large. It's, 110,000 light years across and 30,000 light years deep.
Wow.
So it's gigantic, and of course the universe as we see it is several billion light years across. So it's just the idea of interstellar flight appeals to me, and the idea that there's other civilizations and other ways of handling problems that have been solved by the alien creatures who pilot the UFOs. So it's just sort of that idea of the alien civilizations and the ability to travel interstellar distances.
Well, let's get right to the point. Have you ever seen an alien from another planet?
Oh, well, you can ask it that way, no.
What way should I ask?
Well, usually they say, have you ever seen a UFO?
Oh, okay.
And the answer to that, the answer I normally give to that is no, not really. But as I was growing up, I belonged, or at least went to the meetings of the Denver UFO Society when I lived in Denver, Colorado. And they were having a get-together south of Denver near Castle Rock. And we were all sitting around the campfire at night, and we saw an object, a light that started in about the northern horizon and crossed the sky to the southern horizon. And when it got directly overhead, it flashed once, and somebody in the crowd said, oh, they're signaling us. And I thought, yeah, right. But it was a polar orbit back in the days when there weren't a lot of satellites up, and a friend of mine and I, who were there, tried to determine if there was any satellites in a polar orbit that we would have been able to see at that time, and there weren't. So we don't really know what the light was. It was just sort of intriguing, but it looks like if you go out when the International Space Station goes over and you look at that thing fly across the sky, that's exactly what it looked like. But at that time, there weren't a lot of satellites, and there were none in a polar orbit that matched what we had seen.
Do you really care whether other people believe in UFOs? Whether other people, I mean, when I talked to you last week, it seemed like, you know, it's like you want people to believe that there are some. But
no, I don't want people to reject something because of dumb reasons.
Right, exactly.
And there was a guy I just read online today that he said all the UFO sightings have been debunked, thoroughly debunked, and this is patently false. They haven't been debunked. There's some very good sightings that haven't been debunked. There have been solutions offered to every UFO sighting, but not all of these solutions make any sense. And what I'm passionate about is people going toward the truth. Here's what the truth is. It's not my truth, it's not your truth, but it's the ultimate truth. And I'm passionate about people getting to the truth and try to provide them with enough information about specific cases and the specific things that they can make an intelligent decision on their own, rather than just saying something dumb like, well, all UFO sightings have been thoroughly debunked. Well, no, they haven't.
It must be hard for you to watch the TV and the movies and see the way they portray UFOs, and you must think, well, that obviously looks fake because they have to make it look fake. But I mean, it must be you seeing as much as you've seen, although going through all the pictures and hearing what people had to say. It must be that you realize. Do you realize right away that they're lying, or is it some?
If you're talking about movies, as in movies like Independence Day, I was on the set when they were making Roswell, the motion picture for Showtime, and I pointed out to the director some minor mistake that was made. And he says, "You got to remember, we're making a movie here, not a documentary." And I said, "Well, okay, yeah, I got it. Not a problem."
Otherwise, Kevin, shut up, right?
No, he had actually asked me because one of the things I was doing on the set was to make sure they got the stuff accurate. So he said, "If you see something wrong, let me know." And at one point, they had. The way they had the guard station set up going out to the debris field, I said that wasn't right, and they changed it around so it would be more military accurate.
That must
and
have
I was
been
making
fun.
Sure I was making sure that the people in uniforms were wearing the ribbons in the proper order and the insignia were put on properly and things like that. So he was interested in making sure that we got those things right, but the comment he made about making a movie and not a documentary, I thought was well. Good. So when you look at the movies, it's a movie. I cannot think of a reason that an alien race would invade the Earth. You know, in the movies, they're all the time invading. And,
right.
And if you go back to Independence Day, they want to strip us of our resources. And I'm thinking, why? Everything we have on Earth is available in more abundant form throughout the solar system. In the asteroid belt, if you're looking for the water, you've got the Oort cloud and the Kuiper belt filled with comets that if you melt them, there'll be water. The minerals that you might want are in the asteroid belt, again, in the Kuiper belt, or out beyond that. There's no reason to invade Earth unless you just want to stamp out humanity. And so, you know, I look at the movies like that, and I think those sorts of things, and this is preposterous. Why invade the Earth? You could mine the entire solar system, and there's nothing we could do about it at this point. So I look at that sort of thing, and that kind of annoying. If you go to the documentaries that we see all the time on various channels, I get very annoyed when it's clear that the producers want a specific point of view, regardless of what the facts are. And I don't care whether it's a true believer documentary where everything is real and everything is right, or it's from the other side of the coin, the skeptical side, where there is absolutely nothing to this. Those sorts of things are very annoying because I can always think of counterpoints to them to make the point. You know, I want the information presented in a neutral forum. Now, when I write the books, I try to do that, but oftentimes I find myself taking an advocacy position because it's something that I believe to be true. So if you begin talking about the Roswell UFO crash, for example, I believe that was alien, that this was an alien event. And when I see the documentaries that suggested something else, and I know for a fact that the facts that they are presenting are not quite accurate, that's always very annoying.
I can imagine. That would drive you crazy after a while. I don't know how you could even watch them without getting really angry.
The ones that really annoy me are the ones I'm in, so I just don't want to watch myself on TV.
But that must have been fun with working on that movie, watching the film that, though, nevertheless.
But it sort of destroyed the movie magic, because sometimes I'm thinking, as I'm watching a movie, I'm thinking, you know, where's all the crew in this film? Because there's a number of scenes in the Roswell movie where they're in a hotel room, and it was filmed in an actual hotel room in Sierra Vista, Arizona, if you really want to know. Mm-hmm. And there's like 20 people in this room with the cameras and everything going on, and then you see the actors, and it looks like the room is empty except for them. And I'm thinking, well, you've just spoiled the magic here for me. Because now when I see scenes like that, I think about all the people hiding around the room with their jobs. You know, the sound man and the cameraman and the director and
right. all
the script people and everybody that has to be there to make the thing work. So you know, it loses some of the magic.
Yeah, I would think it would. I think maybe it is a good thing I don't see more movies being filmed. I probably wouldn't enjoy them as much. What fascinates me about your book, Reflections of a UFO Investigator, is that the conflicting things about each, all the events that you go into, you know, what whether they seem real and whether they were credible, is that all the different people involved in the events and how conflicting their views are. How, you know, they seem to have different, you know, what time it was. Nobody seems to be able to agree on things that are that basic.
If you take a look at any event, you're going to have those sorts of conflicts, if people getting it from a different perspective. And if you want to drag it into the sinking of the Titanic, because here's an event that's pretty well documented. I read an interview conducted with a young woman who had left Switzerland, and she was going to Iowa to visit her brother and sister who had moved to the United States from Switzerland, and she was on the Titanic by herself. And when she got to Iowa, she was interviewed by a reporter for the Cedar Rapids Gazette, and she was talking about how the captain was drunk, and as the ship was sinking, all the officers were sitting around playing cards. And clearly that didn't happen. It wasn't true, and you're thinking, why would she think that? And then as you look at some other people's reports, she'd pick that up from somebody else, that somebody had said something like that.
And that happens a lot?
Yeah, that happens a lot. And there's also something called confabulation, and this is not conscious lying. What it is a filling in of details by the unconscious mind, so that as you access the event in your memory, as you try to remember what's going on, and things that may not have made sense to you, the mind finds ways to explain it to you so that some of the conclusions you draw are not right. And then the other thing you have to put up with is, as people discuss the event amongst themselves, for whatever reason, they may feed each other information. So something that someone else saw from a different perspective that you yourself may not have seen is now pulled into your story because you have that bit of information. And then the final thing is the way the investigator asks questions. And you have to be very careful with your questioning because you can add information to that. So the best example is a study that was done by Elizabeth Loftus on memory. And what she talked about there was, it showed people a film of a car running a stop sign and hitting another car, causing an accident. And the question became, did the green car run the stoplight or the stop sign? And the answer was, no, the car wasn't green. But witnesses began to say it was green because the question was, did the green car run this, as opposed to which car ran the stop sign, or did, you know, something like that, something, a more neutral based question. And almost any question you ask implies something. Calling them UFOs, unidentified flying objects, the people at APRO, Coral Lorenzen and Jim Lorenzen, began calling them unidentified aerial phenomenon. because object implies there's some kind of physicality to the thing, and flying implies that it's doing something as opposed to just floating on the wind.
But we really have to be exact when we're talking about UFOs, don't we?
Well, it's part and parcel of the investigator to figure these things out and be careful in asking the questions and not try to introduce facts into the discussion. I did an interview with a couple who'd seen a UFO, and it began with, it was just lights in the sky falling toward the ground, and as the young woman, pretty soon she was describing a dome disc with a bright red light under it. And a few days later, she was describing a dome disc in a cockpit where she could see the pilots. And I eventually found out exactly what they had seen because I went out to the scene where they had made the sighting and saw the same phenomenon. It turned out it was the landing lights at the airport. And if the wind is blowing away from you, you're not going to hear the sound of the aircraft. But I'd seen the same thing they described of the bright light seeming to float down to them. And it was the, where they were and the orientation of the runway and that sort of thing that gave them this false.
And even watching, even seeing stuff on TV can influence you, too. I mean, you think...
Absolutely. But she had decided... I talked to the guy, and he talked about the lights, and then as she talked about it, she began to add all this detail that wasn't there. And clearly what she saw were landing lights in the airplane, so clearly she did not see creatures, and she didn't see a dome disc.
But does she realize that she's just outright lying?
She's not lying. She's telling the truth as she remembers it. It's
right.
The memory that is inaccurate. Hmm. And she's trying to be helpful. She was trying to tell the truth as best she could.
Oh, I see.
There was a study done after the Challenger exploded by a psychologist. And what he did was he gave the students in his freshman psychology class a brief questionnaire about where they had been when they'd learned the Challenger had exploded and things like that. And 3 years later, as they were preparing to graduate, he gave them the questionnaire again with a final question. It says, how accurate do you think your memories are? And it turned out 25% of them couldn't get anything right. Their memories were completely false. One woman wrote she had been at home with her parents when the Challenger exploded, and they watched it on TV. Well, she had been in college because she was in the class.
Mm.
But she said, well, I can't help it. That's the way I remember it.
And she really believed that. So
yes,
it's not really lying is what you're saying.
It didn't matter what she had written down 3 years earlier. She remembered it as being home when it happened. Now, the other side of the coin is 25% of the students got everything exactly right, and they remembered it perfectly, and the rest made some minor errors here and there, but 25% of them got everything wrong.
But you've been doing this for 40 years now. Are there people that just outright lie about what they've seen to get attention to them?
Absolutely.
I mean, does it happen a lot or a little?
I think it happens more than we in the UFO field would like to say. But I think there's an awful lot of that. And the best statistic is about 95% of the UFO pictures were taken by teenage boys.
Really?
Yeah. What are the odds? Well, teenage boys are out there faking about 95% of the pictures.
So do you have some today where people just show you stuff they've taken on their camera phones?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And what does it look like when you see it? I mean, can you tell?
It depends on the picture. If it's a blob of light in the sky, who really cares? It doesn't add anything to our knowledge. I was watching, Fact or Fake Paranormal Files this morning.
Right.
And they had the John Reed. They were investigating the John Reed case. He was the guy that claimed to have killed the alien and had it in his freezer for a while. and they were attempting to duplicate the pictures that he had.
Right.
And their duplication of the picture actually looked better than his picture because he got some stuff in the way, but their picture was just more stunning than his. But they duplicated everything that he had done. And so it's clear that this stuff is becoming easier and easier to fake. A 10-year-old kid with a good computer program can fake some very stunning photographs. Sometimes people see things and they don't know what they are. Again, I think it was Fact or Fake Paranormal Files had a footage of like 200 objects floating over the city in Mexico, and they went down to try to duplicate it, and finally they just released like 50 white balloons into the sky, and it matched exactly what the person had photographed. So and that's a big thing in Mexico, I guess, is launching balloons at weddings. And so you'll see the sky sometimes filled with balloons, and this one person wasn't at the wedding, and it caught their attention and took he or she took a video of it that looked amazing, but they pretty well explained what it was. So there are people who truly believe they photographed something unusual who are mistaken. There are people who, and again, mainly teenage boys who fake the pictures. The only good thing about that is usually some years later they come and confess, say, yeah, I faked that picture. And so we can write that thing off. There are some very good pictures, but most of them were taken 40 or 50 years ago because it was much more difficult to fake a photograph at that time than it is today.
All right. Now, I'm looking at some of the pictures in the book, and they're fascinating. Look, there's one that actually looks like a little mouse on I can't remember which page it's on, but it's interesting how some of them look. You know, right away you think, well, that could be a UFO, and you know, your mind just plays tricks with you. You think, well, you know, you jump to the conclusion, or you're
Well, once again, a UFO would be anything that you can't identify, which is not to say I can't identify it if I have an opportunity to investigate it or something like that. There was a case, I think, that in Utah that was investigated by a Utah professor, and this woman was talking about seeing a UFO the night before, and there was aliens behind the windows and all of this stuff. And they went out to the site the next night, and they saw it again. And he looked over and in the woods saw a similar glow, and he walked over there, and there were some teenage boys launching the hot air balloons, you know, that we used to, they used to fake. And he said, "Are you guys here last night doing it?" And they said, "Yeah, we sure were." And he went back and told the woman what he had seen, and when she had first identified it, she said, "That's exactly what I saw, and now no, that's not what I saw last night." So there are people who have a sighting, and no matter what the solution happens to be, whether it's a true UFO or if it is some trick, they're not willing to give up their UFO experience. And so I'm thinking, had he not gone out the next night with her and seen the event, we would have no solution for that. But the woman clearly believes she'd seen a UFO with alien creatures in it. So
speaking of alien creatures, on page 95, there's a drawing of Pat Roach's what the alien that she saw. She claims that she saw, I should
yes,
say.
Yes.
And I find that fascinating, what the alien looks like.
The thing you don't get in the picture, though, is when I had her draw that, I gave her a green pen. So the alien is drawn in green ink.
Mm-hmm.
So you're little green men.
Do you believe she really saw those aliens?
No. At the time I investigated the case, I thought, when I wrote up the case file and I published the report in a magazine and in other places, I said, unless we come up with some kind of a psychological phenomenon with which we're unaware today, I have no explanation for this case. Since that time, I have learned about something called sleep paralysis, which has affected 50% of the population, and this is where you wake up, or upon going to sleep, you suddenly have this feeling of paralysis. You can't move. You have a hard time breathing. And in 80% of the cases of sleep paralysis, you feel there's an entity in the room with you. And I am convinced that what she experienced was sleep paralysis, because she woke up and she was talking about everybody making noise, and she'd seen the creatures in the room, and they were all going nuts. And she called the police and said there was an intruder in the house and that sort of thing. But I think what happened was she experienced an episode of sleep paralysis, and the entity she believed she saw was a manifestation, what's called a hypnagogic or a hypnopompic hallucination, which are associated with sleep paralysis. I'm convinced that's what she saw. So in this case, this specific case, I think it's sleep paralysis.
All right. But it's different in every case, obviously. I mean, there's different things in every case.
Either
you believe it or you don't after a while. I mean, how long does it take you to really decide in your mind whether it's true? Does it sometimes take weeks and months, or do you...
No, it's an ongoing process. I mean, I was convinced for years that Pat Roach had seen an alien creature and that she had been abducted on board the flying saucer and had been subjected to a physical examination. I believe part of the reason I believe that was I was working with Dr. James Harder, who used a hypnotic regression on her, and he had been recommended by APRO to assist in the investigation because I was not qualified to do hypnosis. And at the time, I mean, he told me, hypnosis, people do not lie under hypnosis. Well, I found out since that that's not necessarily true. They can certainly lie under hypnosis. They can certainly be mistaken under hypnosis. And going back to my notes and looking how the whole investigation was conducted, I could see how he was unconsciously feeding her the information. So we would talk about something, trying to get her relaxed and get a little bit more information, and then we'd use a hypnotic regression. And in that episode of hypnotic regression, she would come back with the facts that we discussed earlier. And the one that I remember was Harder was attempting to validate the Barney and Betty Hill case. They were the couple in New England who were abducted in the 1960s. And he was attempting to validate that case by finding other people who had been abducted. And he had talked about Betty Hill being examined. And in the very next hypnotic regression session, under hypnosis, she said, "Well, I don't remember being examined, but I know I was." And then he asked a additional questions. The other thing with hypnotic regression is very easy to lead somebody. Right. And they can pick up the verbal cues, the visual cues, all kinds of cues from the investigator about what he or she wants, so that if the answer is wrong and the investigator comes back and asks the question again, well, the answer then is changed. And I've seen that in that case, and I've seen it in transcripts published by other abduction researchers, where you can see them subtly leading the witness to where they want them to be. One of the things they do is the witness will say, I don't remember anything, and they say, well, yes, you can remember that. You need to go deeper into deeper sleep, into deeper trance, and you can remember this stuff. You know, there's no reason for you to forget it. And the hypnotist, the researcher, is telling them, you've got to remember something for me. And in one case, it was so blatant, it was almost laughable, where the woman finally couldn't get the answer, and she finally yelled at her, make it up. And so at that point, you know, you've lost the credibility of that witness. A California psychologist who was doing hypnotic regression and abduction research lost his license of practice because he took two patients who believed they had been satanically, ritually abused, and changed them into abductees. They clearly weren't abductees, and I don't believe they were satanically, ritually abused either. But he took what their belief structure was and changed it to what his belief structure was, and he ended up losing his license to practice in California because of that.
Now, in this book, you devote five chapters, to the Roswell incident, which is that the most famous incident ever?
Now. Back when Don Schmidt and I started investigating Roswell in 1989, it wasn't that well known. But now everybody knows it. It shows up in movies all the time. If you remember Independence Day, where somebody asks him about Roswell, and the president is saying, no, that never happened. And the Secretary of Defense, well, that's not exactly true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so it shows up in movies. It shows up everywhere. So it is now the most famous of the UFO incidents. At the time, there were others that would have been far, in a way, more famous than that. The Washington National sightings, where the UFOs were seen over the nation's capital on two consecutive weekends in July of 1952, which brought about what I think of the greatest headline I've ever seen in a newspaper, a real headline in a real newspaper. A banner headline across the top says, "Saucer Swarm Over Capital." I think, yeah, that's right out of a science fiction movie.
Exactly.
But it's a real headline in a real newspaper. So, but there were any number of cases that would, the Socorro Landing in 1964, where the police officer saw the two creatures near the thing, would have been more famous. But now Roswell is certainly the most famous of the UFO cases.
Now, are there today in 2012, are there more or less cases than there were, say, back in the 60s and 70s? I mean, what's the...
Well, it runs in waves, is what happens, and you had a wave of sightings in late June, early July of 1947, and then you had another big wave in 1952 and another in 1957. It seemed like it was coming on five-year cycles, and now the cycle's been broken. 64, 65, 66, a lot of stuff, 73. Then there wasn't a whole lot of stuff going on until we get to 1989, 1990, and then... There was a lot of interest and a lot of stuff going on, and then after 1997, it kind of dropped off, and now we're coming back into a point where we're getting many more UFO sightings and much more interest in the topic.
And are you still just as interested today, 40 years later, as you were then?
I'm more laid back today.
I mean, you don't do as much traveling. You make a point of saying that in the book, hey, you don't travel as much, but... Are you constantly on the phone with people?
I've got a book that I'm finishing up for the 1st of July, or 1st of June, I'm sorry. So I've been in communication with a number of people on aspects of the things I'm talking about in the book.
Would you say you're obsessed with this?
No, more so than anybody who's making a living at something. You know, are you obsessed with radio?
I'm obsessed with books. I know that. And I
admit
that.
There you go. but I mean, you know, it's.
And I'm not saying that to make fun of you. That wasn't the
point.
No,
I understand exactly what you're
saying. I was just interested in how you feel. I mean,
I'm saying no. It's not an obsession, because I can make some money at doing it. It's a hobby that you might say it's a hobby that pays well. for me. And, right. and I, you know, I stress that. And the reason it pays well for me is because I have a way of turning the investigations into cash, which is writing about them.
Right.
And not everybody, contrary to popular belief, everybody thinks they can write and not everybody can. It's more than just putting the sentence together with a subject and a verb and that sort of thing. It's a rhythm and a flow of the paragraphs. It's
absolutely.
A way to bring the stuff together, and it's a way to put everything, a logical way of giving the information and setting it up that way. And you know, if I was really obsessed with something, I think it would be writing as opposed to UFOs. I just put up on Kindle a science fiction novel that took me 30 years to write.
Wow. How many words is it?
Oh, it's not big. It's just
a short story?
No, it's a novel.
It's a novel. Okay.
But the way it it's a throwback to the old pulp novels of the 1930s and 1940s. And so in today's world, we're way too sophisticated to get into that kind of book. And I remember I talked to an editor about it, 25 years ago, and he said, "Well, that's going to be a hard sell because of the book." And so I'd work on it periodically, and finally got it finished. And I thought, "Well, shoot, I'll just put it up as a Kindle book for 99 cents, and if people want to read it, they can go to Kindle and buy it, and I'll make $0.50, and
that's right.
We'll make some money, and everybody will be happy."
And you're doing, and you're entitled to that. I mean, and what you're doing, I think, is admirable. I mean, I love the fact that you investigate these things. I think it's neat.
But the point is, the writing, I think, is more of the obsession than the investigation. Oh, I want to learn the truth. I want to know what's going on out there, and that may be an obsession as well. But I'm fascinated by lots of other things. I mentioned the sinking of the Titanic, of American history. I want to write a book called American History as I Would Teach It, and it starts around the time of Christ. What's going on in the United States back then, 2,000 years ago?
What do people think of you? I mean, what kind of reaction do you get when you go to book signings? Do people think you're valid? I mean, do they look at you as somebody they really?
No, I manage to offend everybody.
Oh, you do?
Well, the problem is there are some very popular people in the UFO field, but they embrace everything. And I don't care how ridiculous the idea is, they embrace everything. And then on the other side of the coin, there are the skeptics and the debunkers who hate everything. They know there's no alien visitation, and anybody who suggests otherwise is a liar or deluded or stupid.
Right.
There is no middle ground for these people.
Well, I told you what happened to me. I saw the bright. My mom and I. We saw the bright light in the sky. That's all I know, and that's all I will ever say. That I saw that bright light, and I thought it was very strange, and then it just disappeared.
But the problem is, I don't embrace everything. They think because I will say, well, this is a valid UFO sighting, that I embrace all the nonsense in the field, like crop circles and cattle mutilations and all this. What I call the subsets of ufology, and I don't accept those. I don't think crop circles have anything to do with UFOs. Cattle mutilations have nothing to do with UFOs, although there's people who try to drag it into that arena. And so because of that, there are people who won't talk to me at all because they're just angry because I don't believe the stuff that they believe.
They want to force it on you. Why?
I have to believe this or else. And my attitude has always been, here is the evidence that I have found. Here's what I think to be the truth.
You make the judgment for yourself.
You take it or leave it.
Right.
I don't see myself as the keeper of the flame, which I think of the skeptics as the keeper of the flame of truth. And then the other side of the coin where everything is true. I met an Air Force officer and was talking to him, and I was absolutely stunned at the stuff he believed. I'm thinking, God, here's a guy who made field grade in the Air Force. He was a major, a pilot, and he just buys all this crap. Where is his powers of discrimination, for crying out loud? Let's look at this and say, you know, this is a little bit far out. We're really not trading emissaries between the Earth and some other planet. It's just not going on. Sorry.
Now, have you become, in all the 40 years, have you become more skeptical or less skeptical, do you think?
I think I'm becoming more skeptical. I've run through the gamut. I've run through from the gamut of the true believer, where everything made sense to me and I believed it all, to the point where I didn't believe any of it, to the point where let's look at it on a case-by-case basis. And one of the things that convinced me to take it on a case-by-case basis was reviewing the Project Blue Book files, Blue Book being the official Air Force investigation on UFOs, and I'm looking through the case files, and I said, this is really shoddy stuff. They're not investigating UFOs. They're just answering. They're just slapping labels on it. You know, if you talk to the Air Force or anybody about Blue Book, they'll say, well, they solved all but 3 or 4% of the cases, and that's simply not true. They labeled them, but they didn't solve them, and one of their labels was insufficient data for scientific analysis. Well, that doesn't tell you anything.
Right.
You don't have an answer for it, but you've got a label on it, and I think about 40% of the cases in the Project Blue Book files are labeled insufficient data for scientific analysis. And one guy was so angry at the Air Force for that, he wrote back and said, well, what more information do you have? I told you the time. I told you where it was. I told you the direction was going. I told you everything I had. What information did I not supply that you could not solve this case or you come up with a solution? And then they changed their mind and said it was unidentified, which is very telling as well.
Now, you on the cover here, you have all the pictures. Now, are these all your personal pictures?
Let's see.
It's interesting because you look through them and there's all kinds of pictures here.
Yes, for the most part, there's a couple of pictures that came about from other sources, but for the most part, they're pictures that I took or pictures of me doing important UFO investigations.
Right, and it's interesting. They're all just one pile, and you know, who doesn't get fascinated by this stuff? I mean, I don't know how you couldn't. I mean, because it's just so. You know, you don't know what, if you've never seen one, how do you believe in it? Now, I mean, I know you say, you know, but I've never seen, other than those bright lights, I've never seen anything that I was convinced was an alien from Mars or wherever they might be from, you know.
Well, let's look at it from another point of view, though. There are any number of claims of extrasolar planets outside the solar system that they've detected. And a lot of them haven't been seen, yet they believe they're there. They're based on the wobble of the star. They're based on periodic dimming of the star, which suggests that there's something crossing in front of it between the star, that star and us. So they've deduced these extrasolar planets in a lot of cases, but they haven't seen them. So do we deny the existence of those planets, or do we say, yeah, they're there?
I don't deny that there are UFOs or aliens from other planets, but you know, I'm kind of in the middle. I kind of don't know which way to go. Sometimes I'm reading your book and I'm believing some of this stuff, and yet you debunk some of it, and I think, well, boy, look how easily I believe that. I mean,
I think as a proper investigator, you have to look at all the facts.
Absolutely.
And you have to present all the facts, and too often the people in the debate treat it just as a debate. Whether they're believers or non-believers.
They just want to argue about it.
There are people who want to argue about it. There are people who just, they will debate it. And in a debate, you marshal the information that supports your point of view, regardless of what that point of view is. You support that point of view. And even if you know information that is valuable to the other side, you don't tell them that because it's a debate. In an investigation, you share all that information.
Right.
And you say, well, what do you make of all of this? And how do you explain this, or why don't you understand this explanation? I've got into an argument with a guy on the ridiculous alien autopsy film. This thing that was released in the mid-1990s claimed to be the autopsy of an alien, had very, very limited footage. And I said to him in the debate just the other day, I said, what is the provenance of the film? And he says, well, why are you asking me that? I don't know what it is. And I said, yeah, that's the point. All we can do is trace it to the guy who's made a lot of money off it, but we can't trace it any further. We can't say this is the government agency it came from,
right.
This is the guy that took the footage, anything about it. We've got this guy who sold it or licensed it to various TV stations and sold copies of the tape, but we can't take it any further. And he's saying, well, it's not up to me to provide the provenance. And I said, yes, it is. Precisely you. So we've got to look at it from that point of view. You've got to look at all of this sort of things. And I think when we get into UFOs, a lot of the time they don't look at that. The MJ-12 documents, these alleged documents that were prepared to brief President Eisenhower. Once again, we have no provenance for them. They appeared at the home of a UFO researcher who had said in the past he was thinking about creating a Roswell-type document to see if he could convince other witnesses to come forward. And lo and behold, a year later, he's got a Roswell-type document in his hand. And people are saying, well, why don't you believe in the MJ-12 documents? Well, there's a very good reason right there.
What's the one question that you get asked more than any that really makes you angry or you get sick of hearing?
I don't think there is. No, I guess the question is, how did you get interested in this?
That you get, you get tired.
I don't have a really good answer for that. You know, I blame my mother, as I've said, for interest in science fiction, but... You know, and that kind of introduced the topic, but it's...
It kind of put that in your head that, here's something interesting, I need to investigate this.
But there's a lot of other things that interest me, too. You know, I can tell you lots of esoteric facts. Did you know that the five companies destroyed with Custer at the Little Bighorn were C, E, F, L, and I? I don't know why this is stuck in my brain, but there it is. The other seven companies... some of them were pretty badly shot up, but they weren't with Custer at the massacre part. They were with Reno on the Hill. But, I mean, there are a lot of things that fascinate me. So I have an eclectic mix of interests, of all, you know, historical interests or UFOs or science. It's just how do you get interested in anything? And I guess
when you go to investigate a case, I mean, are there times when you investigate the case and right away you can tell it's just a big pile of crap and you just walk away from the person? Or do you really seriously investigate every one?
There are times when you know. You can tell within 10 minutes somebody is...
Do you just walk away and tell them they're crazy, or what do you do?
No. I try to be polite. And I think in today's world there's too little... too little of that. People are polite enough, but there are some cases where I've called people bald-faced liars because I've wanted them to sue me.
Oh, really? And did they?
No. because I would have won, because the truth is an absolute defense, and I can prove they were lying. But I needed, in one case, I wanted some documentation that was frozen, and if the guy sued me, then I could subpoena it. I could have gotten discovery.
I see.
But then proved he was lying, which would have helped my case immensely. But a lot of times, things like that, you know, I will do sometimes just to try to ferret out the last little bit of information. But there are people who I've known, based on what they've said and how they describe things, that they weren't telling me the truth.
Well, I don't know, and I don't know if you're married or have kids or whatever. What does your family think of what you do?
Well, when we were out in Utah investigating the Pat Roach case back in 19...
I don't know where you... Where do you live, by the way, right now?
Oh, right. I got to tell people that on the...
No, you don't have to.
I think it says on the book, doesn't it, that I'm...
No, it actually doesn't. I was looking before I called you.
Oh, my goodness. A lot of them say that I live in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. But we were out in Utah investigating the case, and my wife had the long hair with the, parted in the middle, and Ted Bundy was running around in Utah at the time, ferreting out the long-haired girls with the hair parted in the
middle. Now everybody's rushing to the internet now to see where you really live so they can figure out where you really are.
If you go to my blog, it tells you on my blog, and it gives you a post office box so you can email. You snail mail me.
How many things in mail do you get a day? It's like how many things in the mail, and how many emails do you get a day?
How many people communicate through the mail anymore?
Yeah, that's true.
You know, not a lot. I think right now there's 75 emails on my account.
Okay.
I've got to sort through here yet sometime today or tomorrow. If I don't do it tomorrow, there'll be 150. So.
Right. I guess you have to get to the point where, I mean, you're always going to have people that say you're crazy or don't know what you're talking about.
Absolutely. If you don't share their point of view, they get angry with you. People say, what is your opinion? And I'll give it to them, and they'll say, no, that's not right. And I say, no, my opinion.
That's
you
right.
Ask me for my opinion. That's my opinion. You may not agree with it, but it's my opinion. So
how have you had all this patience for 40 years? That's my question.
The other problem is I haven't. So there you go.
But you have a good sense of humor, too. I mean, you're not all, you know, totally serious. You do have a sense of humor. There is a side of you that... They can laugh at some of these things, too.
There's a problem in ufology, which is they have no sense of humor. And that's a bad thing. you know, we've got to kind of joke about this a little bit. For crying out loud, we're talking about aliens, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. You know, why did you give the green pen to Pat Roach to draw the alien? Well, what other color would you give her? I had a green pen, I gave it to her. You know,
yeah.
So I've got a picture of the alien drawn in green for the little green man.
No matter what you do, people are going to question it, especially when you become famous and write books. They right away want to bring you down.
Well, there are people who will argue the minutiae with you, and they don't. In fact, on my blog, we just got into a thing on the neoprene balloon. The guy wanted us to conduct an experiment to find out how long the neoprene rubber would last in the environment after the balloon had deflated. And I pointed out there's no point in doing that because we know, based on observed evidence over the last 40 years, that, you know, the neoprene breaks down in 3 to 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but he just insists that we buy a neoprene balloon and stake it out, I guess, in the yard and see how long it takes for it to break down. Well, we've got the answer from a lot of different sources. We don't need to conduct that experiment. If nobody had done that and we didn't have a good answer for it, well, yeah, that's a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
Let us see how quickly the neoprene rubber breaks down.
And that's the point. You're open to these things. I mean, you're open to anybody's points of view. I mean, you'll listen, you'll take it in, you'll decide for yourself, but you're still open to all this stuff. It's not like your mind is closed.
I believe that alien abduction is explainable in terrestrial terms, meaning there's no alien involvement. But there was somebody that suggested if you gathered up the dust bunnies, we kind of called it the dust bunny experiment, in the houses of abductees and compared it to the dust that you find in houses of non-abductees, you may find a difference in the dust, which would give us a bit of evidence. You know, there might be some sort of meteoric dust, you might say, mixed in with the dust bunnies in the abductees' house. I thought, you know, this is a great idea. I'm all for it. You know, I'll send you dust bunnies from my house if you'll consider it. But the experiment, I think they gathered the material, but they could never get a laboratory who would conduct the analysis of the dust to see if there is any significant difference. If there was, that would be a nice bit of evidence for us to have. But the other side of that coin is there was a what they called the Prairie cameras a number of years ago that would take periodic pictures of the sky, and the cameras were scattered all over the Midwestern of the United States. And once they had completed their analysis of the photographs, the Center for UFO Studies had made a deal with them. They were going to throw out the pictures anyway. We'll give them to us, and we'll analyze them looking for UFOs. I think, well, this is a great idea. Why not? But Philip Klass, the great debunker, just became outraged at this idea. It wasn't going to cost anybody anything except the Center for UFO Studies, but he just caused such a stink that they refused to donate the pictures.
Hmm. Now, this spook light on page 70, that's the one I was referring to. It looked like a little mouse. Do you think that was really something, or do you think that was just lights playing tricks?
I know what it was. And that's the thing with the spook light. When we went down to Joplin to take a look at that, people would say, well, you know, it doesn't show up every night, and people, the Army's looked into it, and scientists have been here, and nobody's been able to explain it. Well, I went back through the newspaper files and discovered, yeah, the Army had investigated, and the Army explained it. A science student from the area had investigated it scientifically and explained it. We got out there, and I looked up, and there it was. We took photographs of the darn thing. But there's a section of highway in Oklahoma, Joplin, Missouri, and where the spook light is, overlooks parts of Oklahoma. And there's a section of highway, and as the cars come down the highway, there's a refraction of the lights, and it gives you the impression there's lights in the sky above this area. The science student, what he had done is he'd put filters on his friend's car, so he'd get like red lights or green lights. They would stop on the highway, not to stop on the highway, but pull off the side, and they would flash signals, so he could see the spook light. And he would see it in the colors that they were doing, and he could read the signals they were flashing. Clearly, that's what it was. But the people in Joplin, or a lot of people in Joplin, were just outraged that we would be down there to, A, investigate it, and, B, that we would be so audacious as to explain what it was. Now, but it's clear what it's clear to me what it was.
Now, you're in this reflections of UFO investigator. What are the things that people are going to be most fascinated by? Now, I just found it fascinating when you were investigating all the different cases, and you know, you used logic and you figured out, you know, in your mind what was really going on. But what do you think people are going to be most interested in when they read this book?
Well, Jerry Clark said he was angry because I didn't include enough personal stuff. You know, I mentioned in passing my military career. He would have liked to have read more about that, and I didn't tell more.
They want to know what makes you tick.
Bud Hopkins had done a book that was more autobiographical. It talked more about his life as an artist and his UFO investigations and things like that. My book, I looked at it as being, you know, this is my investigations of UFOs, as opposed to my life in the military or my life as a college student or whatever. I organized it by where I was and what I was doing at the time I conducted the investigations and how things transpired from there. But it was about the UFO investigations. And so that's the direction I took to do the book. But I wanted to explain how we'd gotten from point A to point B, I guess, in the book. Yeah.
Well, there's always going to be people that say, "Why didn't you put this in the book?" I mean, there's always going to, no matter
you
can never write a perfect book. I mean,
I'm always stunned when I read some of the reviews of my books on Amazon and how somebody can just think it's the greatest thing since sliced bread, and somebody else says, "I cannot believe this dribble was actually
coming." Exactly, it goes from one to the other real quick too.
I'm going. How can these people have read the same book?
Right. Now, your book's what, $15.95? Just so I think that's what it was on Amazon when I looked it up.
The book itself, Kindle, it's $9.99 on Kindle.
And if you buy it in the bookstore, I think it's like $15.95. Is that right?
$15.99, I think.
$15.99. Oh, it just went up 4 cents, just like that.
Well, no. What do you mean? It was years ago they figured out that, you know, all the books cost $4.95 or $5.95, and somebody figured out, you know, if we cost it $4.99. People still say it's under $5, and we get the extra 4 cents.
Right, we're making more money. That's a good
thing. Well, but and if you're talking about 10-12 books, that's not a lot of dough. But when you start talking about a million, 2 million books, that's a nice pile of cash.
Are there people that do what you do, investigating UFOs, who are nuts, in your opinion?
Oh, absolutely.
Are there a lot of them, or just a little? Have you met people that you just couldn't even stand to talk to after a while?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And in fact, in Roswell at Celebration last year at the festival, we were talking about, I was explaining the Robert Willingham case and why I came to believe that Willingham wasn't telling the truth. And this guy wanted to argue with me about that. He wanted to argue from his point of view of theory and speculation. And I wanted to argue the facts. He said, "Well, what if you found a document that said blah, blah, blah?" I said, "There are no documents like that, because if there were, I would have found them."
Right.
You know, the guy claimed to be an Air Force officer. There's absolutely no evidence he was an Air Force officer. Well, maybe they changed his records. Impossible. Because there are all kinds of ancillary sources for this stuff, and they wouldn't get them all. You know, he claimed to be an Air Force officer and a fighter pilot. Well, he would have had to train in... At the time, I think San Antonio is where they were doing the training. There are records there that you could access, find the guy's name in them, but you can't do it. You can't find anything. If you go to the internet, I actually found a picture of my flight school class from 1967 on the internet. So, I mean, I didn't put it there. I don't know who put it up, but I was just looking at something, and blam, there it was. So I downloaded a copy of the picture so I'd have it.
Has anybody ever convinced you? Taking it the other way. I'm sure you have argued with people who really knew what they were talking about, other than this guy that you were just talking about. There are people out there who do know what they're talking about. Have you ever been convinced of something?
Boy, and I shouldn't say this because I'll make Stan Gordon mad. But,
maybe he won't be listening.
but the thing is, the Kecksburg UFO crash, I am now convinced, based on the evidence, that it was a meteor, and the meteorite men on the Science Channel helped convince me because of the videos that they played at the beginning of the show a number of times, and some of the scientific evidence, including a scientific paper or two that were published. I did say, well, you know, how come nobody found the strewn field, which is where the meteorites are scattered? And they said, yeah, it's up in Canada. And I said, oh, okay. So I think in that case, looking at the evidence, here's a case that I had believed at one time to be a solid UFO case that I now am pretty well convinced it was meteoric in origin.
So you can be convinced?
Oh, absolutely. If the evidence is there, you can't really say, you know, people say, well, are you sure that what fell at Roswell was alien? Well, 99% sure, because there's always that 1% chance you could be wrong.
Absolutely.
Regardless of what the evidence is you've seen, you could be wrong.
I enjoy hearing what you have to say, and you really are knowledgeable. It's obvious. I mean, from the facts in the book, you've collated a lot of information, and you've got it all organized, and you can talk the talk. You really know what you're talking about. Now, are you 100% right? I don't know, but you know, you sound it.
I think it's like anything else. I like to be right more often than not.
Right.
When the MJ-12 documents were first came out, I was convinced they were real, because of the stories that were being told. And as time passed, and we looked at more evidence and more things came out about it, I became convinced that they are fraudulent.
Well, do you believe that Betty and Barney Hill were really taken up by aliens somewhere?
No.
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 And what's the main reason you say it didn't happen?
I don't think there's good evidence that aliens are abducting people.
Are there any cases where you really are convinced somebody was abducted by an alien?
No.
Not a one.
No, not the abduction scenarios as it's played out today. It doesn't make any sense. If you look at it from one point of view, you know, they're trying to steal our DNA for whatever purpose.
Right.
And I'm thinking, well, why don't you just abduct the trash can behind a barbershop?
That's right.
Get all the DNA there you want. You don't have to. Or why abduct people and put them back into society? Why not just keep?
See, it doesn't make sense in your mind.
No, it doesn't make logical sense. And the genetic experiments being conducted on board the UFOs are the same today than they were 50 years ago. They don't seem to learn by anything, and the experiments they were conducting were crude by 1950 standards.
Well, how have you changed in the 40 years? I mean, how has your outlook on life changed? I mean, you said you've become more skeptical, but I mean, how else have you changed?
Ufologically or generally?
No, just in general. What were you like when you first started out? What are you like now? I mean, what are the major changes there?
Oh, I probably bring a little bit more passion to it now than I did early on, simply because I know more about it. And I want to make sure that the information is accurate. And I think,
well, that's important. Yeah.
I think in the beginning, I didn't look as far or as deeply as I needed to look into some of the cases. I was more willing to be convinced of the reality of the UFO as opposed to trying to find out whether there was an explanation for it. And I think now I'm more skeptical, which is not to say I won't accept a UFO sighting as being something truly extraterrestrial, but I'll look at it.
But there has to be hard evidence in your mind.
Well, the testimony is good, but like I said, the one case where I went out and I saw what they had seen, that was an interesting case, but I could see the evolution of the girl's testimony. The boy's testimony didn't seem to change. We had a series of drawings from that event, so I could see the evolution of what she was saying. And I've been criticized for that. I mean, some woman wrote to me and said, "Oh, you just believe in the boys, not the girls." She's a girl. I'm thinking, no, I'm not believing the girl, because I've been out to the site and I've seen what she saw and I've seen the evolution of her story.
Now, if somebody's emotional about it, you tend to believe them more than if they're not.
Emotion has nothing to do with it.
Nothing to do with it at all.
In fact, there's a wonderful book called Stolen Valor.
Right.
And they would. It's about guys who pretend to be Vietnam veterans. And the psychologists and the therapist said, well, you know, the emotion that they display is just so real. And then you check the guy's record and you find out he wasn't even in the Army.
Oh, wow.
Let alone in Vietnam. And so the emotion means nothing. You know, it's they bring to the table the emotion they think is appropriate for it. The emotions mean
nothing. Are there any facial things that you can...
Oh, absolutely.
That you make you tell that somebody's lying?
I did a lecture once about body language. Right. I said, does anybody look at body language? And I showed him a video of a guy talking about his story. And I said, watch, this guy's lying. And they said, how do you know? I said, he's shaking his head no as he's talking to us. He's telling me he's not telling me the truth. And nobody looks at this stuff.
Right.
You know? So that's the way it goes.
Right. Well, I mean, you're a fascinating guy. I mean, I've enjoyed this immensely. I mean, am I convinced one way or the other? I think I favor your non-belief in a lot of these things, because I think you have, I mean, to me, you just seem like you know what you're talking about, and I trust you because you've been doing it for 40 years. And you sound trustworthy, too, which doesn't necessarily mean anything. But
and longevity in a field doesn't make you trustworthy either. I can point to a number of people who have been around longer than I have, and I wouldn't trust them if they told me the sky was blue and the
but
ground
you,
was
but
green.
You have a quest for the truth, though. And in that quest, I don't see you as, you know, making stuff up as you go along.
Me and Josh Gates.
Hmm?
Me and Josh Gates.
Yeah. I don't know who Josh Gates is.
He did the show on Sci-Fi Channel called Destination Truth.
Oh, okay.
A Quest for the Truth.
But, I mean, I wonder, and this will just be like the last question, but I wonder, what would you like on your tombstone?
Nothing. I plan to live forever.
Right. Are you going to
die in the attempt?
Do you think there'll be one day that you'll know for sure whether all these things are true? I guess that's almost like a question of do you believe in heaven? Do you believe that God will tell you one way or the other?
Well, we can say if something lands tomorrow, and there it's announced on television, then we'll know the truth. You know, maybe we will find some evidence that will convince practically everybody that of the truth. But there's no way to convince everybody. I mean, there's still people who don't believe we landed on the moon. They're convinced there was a great trick played on the American public.
Mm-hmm.
For some bizarre, no, on the world for that matter.
I didn't even realize that Roy Thinnes was curious about alien stuff. I mean, after the Invaders. I mean, I used to watch the Invaders when I was a kid, but I didn't realize he had such a fascination with it.
Yes, and I impressed some people by saying I'd broken bread with Roy Thinnes. So
that is impressive.
We went to dinner, and every morning at the hotel we'd be down there. And I say we, it was Don Schmidt, Tom Carey, and I, and Roy Thinnes would come down and join us. So we had breakfast with Roy Thinnes 4 or 5 days in a row.
That's great.
I never thought watching Roy Thinnes on The Invaders, I would one day be sitting down chatting UFOs with him.
And you met David Letterman, too. There's a picture of him in the book with you.
Yes,
with
in Iraq.
Right.
In my... We're sitting there, and I'm thinking, boy, my wife will be really impressed because she watches Letterman. And so he threw the show over to Paul Schaefer, and I went up and said, you might let me have a picture taken with you because my wife will go nuts. And the guy who took the picture, Major Cheney, and,
mm-hmm.
You'd say, Cheney, any relation? He'd go, Uncle Dick. But he wasn't related to the vice president. He took one picture, and after that, I said, why did you only take one? I said, it's a digital camera, for God's sakes. You could have taken 100. It wouldn't have cost any more. He just took the one picture. So I have the one picture of me and David Letterman.
All right. Well, we've just about run out of time. This has been great. I've really enjoyed this, Kevin.
It's been a quick hour.
That's the beauty of these interviews. They go so quick, the authors don't even realize that they've answered so many questions.
Oh, I've been watching my clock.
Have you?
Yes.
The book, again, is called Reflections of a UFO Investigator. You can get it from Amazon. You can get it from any bookstore, and you can get it on the Kindle, like he said, or any other device.
Or you can get it on the Nook. Or
I know, there's so many of them now.
A number of e-readers. I just say Kindle because... when I put my stuff up, I do it on Kindle because it's easier for me.
Well, I wish you all the best. I hope you find out. I hope you find more answers.
Well, I thank you very much, and it has been an enjoyable conversation.
Right. And this has been David's Book Talk. We will talk to you next time.